Where did retirement fit in the arc of your life? Where did retirement fit in the novel that each of us writes with our life?
We're here for the retirement party.
Follow the headless brakeman.
Tonight, we've all come to honor a close friend of ours.
Our guest is the recently retired co-creator of Philosophy Talk, John Perry.
Please don't make me retire. My job is the only thing that keeps me alive. I never married and my dog is dead.
I wasn't forced to retire.
Who gets to retire?
Is retirement just some evil scheme that capitalists invented to get rid of older, higher-paid workers?
I spent 40 years watching more talented, more gifted graduate students struggle to get any kind of employment. So I really felt it was time to move on.
What advice does John have for anyone thinking about retirement?
Turns out what I really like is what I like to do when I was 8 years old. Sit in a room and read and write.
The Philosophy of Retirement, coming up on Philosophy Talk.
Nice work if you can get it, and you can get it if you try.
Is retirement the best thing that could ever happen to a person?
Or is it just a capitalist ploy to rotate more expensive, experienced workers out of the labor force?
Is there a philosophical way to spend your retirement years?
This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Accept your intelligence. I'm Deborah Satz.
I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the Campbell Recital Hall on the Stanford campus.
Our thinking originates a stone's throw away at Philosopher's Corner. That's where Ken and I teach philosophy.
And I co-direct the Philosophy and Literature Initiative.
Welcome, everyone, to Philosophy Talk. Now today, we're philosophizing about retirement. And we wanted to get started by hearing how today's retirees are faring. And so we sent a perfect person, our roving philosophical reporter, Liza Veal, out to meet some of them in the wild. She files this report.
I met Daryl and his friend Gene at a donut shop. Daryl's actually not quite retired, but the question of whether he's saving enough to be able to retire is heavy on his mind.
That's a billion-dollar question. That is, you know, I don't know.
He's 62. He works at Enterprise Rent-A-Car during the day and UPS at night.
That's the first thing you should worry about as soon as you graduate from high school is retirement, especially if you're not born with a silver spoon in your mouth. Yeah, you know. I was not. I had the carpet spoon.
Gene, on the other hand, has been retired for 12 years. He was a municipal electrician, and he thanks his union for what he sees as a dignified life.
I was basically just very lucky.
Why?
Well, when I got out of the Army, I just kind of fell into this job at the City of Berkeley, you know. In the first union vote, I voted for the money rather than the benefits, you know, and the old-timers looked at me like, you fool, you know. Because you can't convince a 23-year-old he's ever going to retire, you know.
Superman, huh?
Daryl and Gene gave me a whole lecture about how people younger than they are don't know the importance of a job that you can retire on.
They're what I call wage slaves.
Nowadays, everybody want to be associated with a brand name. Well, these companies are not contributing to their behalf. They're burning you out. You know, you got to fend for yourself. What do they call that in Europe? You was a serf, you know? You're a serf!
Daryl is saving enough that he thinks he'll be okay, as long as he isn't hit with something catastrophic. But after talking to people, it seems like not planning for catastrophes is a common downfall.
I probably could have saved more. Everybody could.
Like Virgil Todd, who I met at a senior center.
I wasn't shooting for, you know, high on the hog. You know, sufficient is good enough.
He worked in parking enforcement at UC Berkeley. Virgil was a softie on the parking job. He says he gave more warnings than anyone else gave tickets. But he fondly remembers busting the dean of the ethics department for a fraudulent parking permit. When Virgil retired, he took out all his savings at once and invested it all.
I had, you know, pretty good money coming in from the investments until my daughter needed an operation. And I was the only one with money. So it was my turn. You know, now I'm considered poor. But poor is okay. You know, I got a lot of company.
Now he's 87. He comes to the senior center to make these beautiful ceramic beads. and get an affordable lunch.
They sort of raced, you know, an awful lot of older people had this race, trying to figure out how to keep the money, enough money to go on before they die, you know. And they actually kind of figure that maybe dying a little early is better than dying without no money, you know.
When Virgil says he's not alone in being poor, it's true. Like a lot of people around his age, he's living off Social Security, which for him is $1,200 a month. But the thing about Social Security is, when it was first designed,
it was not intended to be the only salary that somebody would have in their older age.
Blanca Castro is an advocate with the American Association of Retired Persons, or the AARP. And she says Social Security was supposed to be the safety net of last resort, not the whole country's sole retirement plan. Its funding has been cut over the decades, and meanwhile, more and more people have come to depend on it. A trend that's going to grow, because right now,
we know that majority are not saving for retirement. They are not saving for a number of reasons.
Number one reason is our jobs are no longer helping us. They're less likely to offer pensions or an employer-matched savings option. Number two is other costs like housing are just higher. Retirement is being treated more and more like the responsibility of the individual. Other countries have taken the opposite tack. In Australia, Japan, the UK, for example, the state, the employer, and the employee are all required to contribute to retirement funds. Here, we're on our own.
We're already seeing an increased number of people who are unable to retire. They either own their house and they're scraping by, or they absolutely are going into poverty, and there definitely is an increase in older adults faced with homelessness, or they're living with family.
It's just the beginning of a tide of aging seniors that will depend on the rest of us for basic needs. Blanca Castro has dedicated her life to changing our country's approach to retirement. But for at least a few generations, it's already too late. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Liza Veal.
Thanks for that report, Liza. That was a powerful report, and you're an amazing storyteller, and I love having you on Philosophy Talk. I'm Ken Taylor, here with my colleagues Deborah Sass and Josh Landy at Campbell Recital Hall on the Stanford campus, and we're thinking about the philosophy of retirement.
We're also making an important transition for the program because our guest today is the co-creator and host emeritus of Philosophy Talk, John Perry. John recently retired after co-hosting the program with Ken for 13 years, and that was after retiring from teaching at Stanford and UCLA for 40 years.
Yeah, so Stanford, he retired from Philosophy Talk, he also retired from UC Riverside. This guy is multiply retired. But he's not just sitting around all day playing golf and doing some pruning. He's been writing papers, giving talks, all kinds of important stuff like that.
So John has spent his retirement from being a philosophy professor by hosting a philosophy radio show, teaching philosophy at a university, and writing philosophy papers. What's wrong with this picture?
Yeah, but you know, by the same token, who better to ask about what retirement means for a well-lived life? Please welcome back to the Philosophy Talk stage, John Perry.
Welcome back, John.
So, John, it seems like retirement agrees with you because you keep doing it over and over again. So, do you think of it, though, as an advance or as a retreat in your life?
Advance or series of advances. I first retired from Stanford in 2008, and I thought I was the perfect paradigm case of retirement doing just what it should do. I had TIA CREF from Stanford. I was 66, so I was eligible for Social Security, and I got the full load of Social Security.
And you also got our faculty retirement incentive fund.
Yes, I also got a bonus for retiring early.
Yes.
So I thought I was set, and I wanted to make room for the younger, brighter people that were coming along. And I felt out of touch. I mean, I would give a lecture to freshmen, and I would use Meg Ryan in an example, and they would say, who? Meg who? Meg who? Yeah. And so I thought it was perfect, but then something happened. I retired in 2008, and my retirement precipitated a worldwide recession. So I decided...
We wanted to bring you back.
So. Well, I decided I would not hit the IRAs right away, and so I got a kind of a half-time job, just had to fly down once a week to Riverside for 2 quarters, give a seminar, and that helped pay my 10 grandchildren's college tuition, which I hadn't really realized how absurd college tuition had become. So I had to retire again.
But John, I remember that. I was chair when you retired.
Yeah.
And I didn't want you to retire.
No.
I thought you weren't done. There was no way you were done doing philosophy. There was no way you were done teaching. You went on to teach for why did you retire then? I mean, it wasn't like you were at the lull of your philosophical powers. I can name all the stuff you've written then. So why retire at that point?
Well, one reason has to do with how I got hired in the first place. And this will be a very depressing story. If there's any graduate students in the audience, it was a couple days before Thanksgiving in 1967. Frenchie and I were living with our 2 kids at Hasbrook Apartments at Cornell, and we got these tubes. And in the tubes were rolled up pictures of scenes from Los Angeles. The beach, Hollywood. We had no idea why they were there. Then a couple days after Thanksgiving, and I had not applied for any jobs. I had not prepared a CV. I got a call from Don Kalish, chairman of the department at UCLA, who said, I'm offering you a position as an assistant tenure track professor at UCLA. Now, why? Because I was so brilliant? No, because I was a war baby. There weren't many war babies. The baby boomers were coming in as freshmen, and they were desperate. And then I spent 40 years watching more talented, more gifted graduate students struggle to get any kind of employment. So I really felt it was time to move on.
So it sounds like you're saying it was good altruistically to retire, but do you feel that it's been good for you personally?
I wouldn't have retired solely on altruistic reasons. But the other thing was that I really do enjoy doing philosophy, publishing philosophy, and teaching interferes with that. I mean, I think teaching is great. I think it's the best thing we do for the world. But it, you know, I wasn't getting my books done the way I wanted.
But you didn't really have an option to go from full time to zero time. Would you, if there had been a way to more seamlessly go to quarter time position, would have that been a good option?
Well,
and why don't we think about options like that?
Well, I think that probably was an option. I wasn't forced to retire, but Stanford offered, and this was a result of a committee I was on a long time ago, but it wasn't, I think 2 times your annual salary if you would retire when you became eligible for Social Security at 66. And if you don't think about the tax bite, because they pay it all at once, that seems like a pretty good deal. But then once you do that, you can't come back and teach at Stanford except for peanuts.
So, but I want to ask a question about the arc of your life. I mean, every life has an arc. I know you don't like the narrative.
It has a starting point, but we haven't quite reached.
But every life has an arc. I mean, do you think, were you at a point in your life where it just made sense to retire because of the arc of a well-lived life? There's a place in a well-lived life where retirement naturally comes.
So this is the kind of Ken Taylor, Josh, Landy, Frederick, Nietzsche approach to things. Where did retirement fit in the arc of your life? Where did retirement fit in the novel that each of us writes with our life? And I suppose the honest answer to that, it didn't occur to me to think about it.
Okay. Which
it occurred to me to think about. Occurred to me to think about is I got 3 books that I owe publishers, and there's no way I can get them done unless I retire. And it turned out there was no way I could get them done even if I did retire, but I didn't realize that.
Now, you were reasonably fortunate, though, because as
Absolutely.
You said, you were in a great position, you had a good retirement package, and then when that changed things for you.
Well, I'm still in a good position. I mean, you know, flying down once a week to give a seminar to bright graduate students isn't exactly poverty. And I was able to put all my grandchildren through college, and I still have a lot of money. So, no, I have what I think retirement should be, and what I suppose Franklin Roosevelt thought it should be when he came up with Social Security, and what we used to think it would be for any working person because they would work for a firm that had a program like Stanford does that would supplement Social Security, but it's not what it's like now.
This is Philosophy Talk, coming to you from Campbell Recital Hall on the Stanford campus. Our guest is my longtime co-host and friend and inspiration, now host emeritus, John Perry.
In our next segment, we'll think about how retirement fits into the larger social picture. Does our society have it right about how retirement should work, or does retirement just show how faulty the whole way we've set up our employment and leisure system are?
And we're also going to consider the shape of the retiree's life, whether John wants to or not. What steps can we take to make our retirement meaningful?
Making retirement meaningful for the individual and for society, along with questions from our retiring or non-retired or awake audience when Philosophy Talk continues. Thanks to our musical guest, Amber Gugis and Marco Casasola. This is Philosophy Talk. I'm Ken Taylor with my new Stanford colleagues and new collaborators, Josh Landy and Deborah Satz.
Our guest is John Perry, who recently retired from co-hosting Philosophy Talk. He also previously retired from teaching at Stanford and from UC Riverside and probably some other school that doesn't fit on his CV.
What comes to mind when you think about retirement? Finally not having to work or starting a whole new career? Traveling the world or sitting quietly at home doing a bit of pruning every now and again? What changes does retirement bring to the story of your life? Join the discussion by stepping up to one of the microphones at either side of the stage.
So John, I just read in the New York Times a review of a new book co-authored by Martha Nussbaum, where she says that retirement is one of the greatest moral outrages of the 20th century. That's probably an exaggeration, but she compares people retiring on an age-based rationale, the way you were describing, to make room for others, as if women would retire early to make room for men so that they could have jobs. So what do you think about that argument?
It occurred to me, what if you'd asked Martha, would it be a good idea to make men retire so that there would be more jobs for women? And she might have gotten a different result. But I think she has a point. She says, you know, being old is like being a woman or being a man or being black or being Jewish. It's, you know, it's a category you belong to, and you should not be treated differently on account of it. On
especially
the other hand,
if you're old, black, Jewish, and a woman.
Yeah, yes, right. I think Sammy Davis has retired. But on the other hand, if you're retiring, it's because you had a job. So forced retirement, I do think not having forced retirement is a good idea. Not solely for Martha's reasons, but also because it encourages people to make retirement attractive.
Well,
right?
But look, retirement is a late occurring social formation of the Industrial Revolution, where lots of people were doing back-breaking, repetitive, mm-hmm. boring work. My father was a UAW person, and they had 30 and out, and you could retire. He retired at 55 with a really good pension. Mm-hmm. He's now 88. He's been retired for all those years. But after he retired, he got a less back-breaking job. So, yeah, sure, retirement in the Industrial Revolution from back-breaking labor mm-hmm. that was repetitive and boring and not work, not mm-hmm. philosophy, of course that's a good thing. Martha's thinking of herself. She's thinking of professors,
aww.
Right? I mean, what do you think, John?
Well, I know non-forced retirement for professors didn't come that long ago. Pat Supes had to retire.
That's a former colleague of ours, one of the great philosophers of the 20th century.
I couldn't see that it made any difference. He started three businesses after he retired, all of which Stanford now owns and benefits from. But I think non-forced retirement and having an incentive like I got is a great idea. But I think we need to think more basically about it. I mean, basically, you got consumers, you got producers, you have an economy you want to keep thriving, and there's no law that says everybody should work or everybody should work for a certain amount of time. We should think through how would this work to keep the economy thriving, but nobody does that. They think of it in terms of justice or something.
But in an ideal society, would there be such a thing as a retirement, or would people work less than they do now but continue contributing and participating throughout their lives?
In an ideal society?
Well, how would I know? You don't even have to go to ideal societies. Just take the long view of human history and the organization of human production. There are less developed societies that are still agricultural or nomadic or something, in which the old, what do the old become? They don't retire. They become like the priestly class. That is, they become wise. They're supposed to give advice. They're no longer in the day-to-day management of the household or the farm, but they have a role, right? A role suited to their age. Retirement is like, okay, you give up labor. It's interesting because you don't give up being a citizen, you don't give up political rights, but you give up that status, that being a producer in the economy. And it's like, okay, it's time for you to do that.
That does seem like something we've importantly lost, right? Maybe Martha's giving that in part, the notion, okay, so even leaving aside forced retirement, even if we just start with a kind of a default assumption that you're going to work for a while and then you're going to stop working, it's easy to slide from that to you're going to be useful to us for a while and then you're going to be useless.
Well,
and that
yeah,
seems to
yeah,
start
just,
sounding
just about this cultural variation, there are societies where that's what's done. That is, once you reach a certain age, you give all the property over to your son or your daughter or whatever, and you lose all rights, right? You lose all rights.
And we know King Lear and what happened there.
Yeah. So there's a highly cultural variable. But what do you think, Joe?
Well, I think it's another way in which being a philosophy professor is better than even being other professors, because philosophers, unlike mathematicians and so forth, typically peak at 74.
The age you aren't yet, or
yes,
just turned.
Just turned, yeah. But, you know, I mean, if I was a computer scientist, would it be a good idea that I would be an elder? What would I say? Well, make your effing fonts larger, millennials. I can't read anything. And why don't we go back to Lisp or even Fortran? I mean, we live in a world in which things are changing so fast that it's hard to have practical wisdom about the world you come to live in.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about the philosophy of retirement in front of a live audience in the Stanford campus, and we've got questions from that audience. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, sir.
Thank you. My name is Carl. So my question is, apart from this little bobble in the stock market, is there anything in your retirement, your three great retirements, that you regret? Anything at all that you regret?
Trump's being elected.
That wasn't your doing.
I mean, I got very depressed a year ago. I don't quite remember why. And since then, I've been like that little guy in Liza's thing, the one that had a cubicle in his living room. Well, I have my daughter, who's sitting there, I have her old bedroom, and I get up in the morning, and I sit there, and I write philosophy, smoke a pipe for a month, then quit for a month, then go back and smoke a pipe for a month. It, you know, without that, I would probably have to be hospitalized over whatever it was I was depressed about. So that's my only regret. And as Ken nicely points out, it wasn't totally my doing, although you couldn't tell that from the email I get from the Democratic Party.
Josh, you have a question for Josh, right?
Yeah.
Josh,
yeah. I mean, you admitted to having caused the 2008 stock market crash.
Yes.
You know, bets are off. So, but I guess I wanted to pick up on that to force you back on the terrain you don't want to get onto.
Yes.
The narrative.
A narrative, right.
Right? So you are a special case in many excellent ways, but consider there may be other people for whom retirement's a time to take stock, right? Among other things.
Mm-hmm.
Many people write their memoirs. So, mm-hmm. And many people, even if they don't write their memoirs, are thinking about how their life went, and they may have regrets, unlike mm-hmm. you, lucky and virtuous man.
Mm-hmm.
And they may think to themselves, gosh, retirement's an opportunity for me to set something straight.
Yeah.
No?
Oh, no, I'm trying to set some things straight. For example, I think I dominated the philosophy department from 1974 till 2008, mostly for the good, but occasionally being obnoxious. I remember Ken, bless his heart, when he was chairman, had a great idea, and I didn't like it, and I shot it down, and I got home, and I thought, Jesus, why am I doing that? I mean,
I was wondering the same thing.
I mean, not that I was insincere, but these are young people who are in touch with the profession, you know.
So what are you doing to make amends?
So what I'm doing to make amends is staying out of department business with one small exception, which was something I wanted to get done before I retired. Wasn't that, I won't say what it is.
Yeah. So this is retirement as not ending productive, meaningful work, but as transitioning.
A new chapter.
A new chapter. Back to
so that. And one thing, you know, we should separate work and paid work, right? So a lot of people might end paid work, supposing they have a pension, but still contribute and find things to do that are important. I mean, you're still writing philosophy.
So Deborah,
they don't pay much for that, do they?
Deborah, do you think in an ideal society, since you like to talk about ideal societies, that the pay you get would have anything to do with the job you do? Or you just think people would get what they need to do a thriving life and they would do what they want to do because they enjoy it?
That's another long topic on distributive justice.
Yeah.
But I do think the way we've set things up so that you're working, employed, and then you're completely unemployed sets up the worry, first of all, that you'll not have enough resources, that you'll be vulnerable, that you'll be, you know, easily oppressed or isolated, and that the quality of your life will decline.
It sets up that worry especially in an atomized, individualistic society that cares not about the collective problems like ours has become increasingly. Again, my father was dying to retire. He lived through strike after strike after strike in the UAW. I remember a 3-month strike when he was just living off the strike the wage that they pay into the strike fund in it. A 3 or 4 month strike when I was a young kid. They won their health benefits. They won their retirement benefits. The union enabled him to say, I'm out of here at 55, right? Those things have disappeared in the society. In other places around the world, they're disappearing, but they still care more about the collective space than we do. So it's contingent upon how we decide.
Unions are gone. I mean, they're not gone, but they're not the force they used to be. You know, back when I was a kid, the big question was, what do you call it, right to work. Right to work was the right wing's way of saying no unions, because right to work meant you couldn't be forced to pay union dues.
Right.
Well, that's kind of an irrelevancy now. The union side of it has kind of become impotent. The right wing side of it is in control of everything. That's my own personal view.
Oh, you never were political on the show before you were hosting.
Yeah. But, you know, philosophers have the job of rethinking the whole thing. Why is this link between what you do and what you're paid? Isn't the relation between what you're paid and what you need more important? We have all these myths that philosophers should help us get rid of. For example, golf. Lots of people think, oh, when I retire, I'm going to play golf. I mean, that is absurd. I played golf for about 20 years, and then I had a philosophical move, and I realized this is the worst, the most depressed I felt all week. And besides, I'm hot and sweaty. I remember going out with my father when he was retired. He moved to a golf course, and we'd be playing along, and he'd, you know, deaf a thing, and he'd throw his club. But that's a myth. Oh, once you're retired, you can play golf.
Well, okay,
nobody in their right mind wants to play golf, and that's a relatively minor myth.
Okay, let's take another question. Welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Hello, I'm Judy. I'm at the Center for Behavioral Sciences this year as a fellow. I must say that a lot of the women I know retire early do so to look after their parents, and I wanted to go back to the issue of gradual retirement. I mean, I've read lots of studies that say that it's much better to retire gradually, to not go from full-time work to retirement, but to have flexible retirements, to work part-time 20%. And that would allow for a lot of the caring work that goes on, much of it which is unpaid, to be done. And actually, there's more and more of that work that needs to be done because we're living longer and longer. So I just wondered how you would respond to that, to this choice we've got at the moment, which, if we're lucky, to go from very good full-time work to full retirement.
I'll just say a word about that. That was not what I planned to do, but it's what, in effect, I did. I retired from here, gave up a full-time job, but then with the recession, I took a part-time job at Riverside, not too demanding. And then when I got done with that, I planned not to do anything, but then Berkeley asked me to come over and give a course or two, and I think Berkeley is such a fascinating, wonderful institution and has a great historic department with a lot of friends. So I did that for a couple of years, not because I needed the money. So I've had a very, you know, whatever you call it, retirement. And then the last thing is philosophy talk, a wonderful experience. But after 13 years, it's time to make room for the younger generation.
But that could be, I do think that could be elevated into a paradigm.
Yeah.
That people's, right. And these societies that change the nature of the work that older people do gradually, that makes a lot of sense to me. I don't know why we don't do things.
Right.
Like
that. So that was, you know, the question I was asking you before about we have really two main choices. Mm-hmm. Academics are a little luckier mm-hmm. in that we can sometimes go part-time. For a lot of people, it's either you're in or you're out. And that is, you know, can be a shocking change and an isolating one and a disempowering one.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're thinking about retirement with our recently retired host emeritus, John Perry.
In our final segment, we're going to ask our host emeritus about some practical advice for making retirement more than just a period of sitting back and being done with work, but instead making it the capstone to a well-lived life.
Maybe we should also ask him for some practical advice about how to deal with his former co-host.
We're coming to you from Campbell Recital Hall. We'll take more questions from our audience when Philosophy Talk continues.
The best is yet to come from the day you're mine. We've only tasted the wine. Listen, come the day you're mine.
Thanks to our live musical guest, Amber Gugis and Marco Casasola. I'm Ken Taylor. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Deborah Satz, and along with our colleague Josh Landy, we're thinking about retirement with our colleague emeritus, John Perry.
So, John, if the best is indeed yet to come for people approaching retirement, what wise advice do you have? You've been elevated to priestly status. What wise advice do you have for how people can make the most out of it?
Well, when I was at Stanford for a long time, from about 1976 on, I used to give a talk to the whole freshman class when they came in for orientation. And what I told them was not totally unbiased. It was partly to squeeze some philosophy majors out of the group. And what I told them is, you've got a unique opportunity, 4 years in college. You need to have your decisions based on you, your beliefs, your desires, and not the ones that were poured into you by your parents, your church, your whatever, over all these years. You got 4 years, you got a lot of units to play with. So find out what you really care about, what you're living. It was very good advice, and it's the only way we got any of those people that came to be pre-meds to transfer to philosophy. I think retirement.
So you're responsible for the dearth of doctors.
Yes. I think retirement is like that because now, since being a freshman and graduating, you've had another 40 or 50 years of kind of basing your desires and beliefs and what you care about largely on extraneous things. If you're working for Stanford, you have to care about Stanford. If you want to make it as a professor, you got to write stuff to get tenure, and it has to be stuff that the journals like and the referees for the journals like. And then all of a sudden you're retired, and you can be like a freshman. You can say, "But okay, what, you know, what?" And I was surprised because if you'd asked me 20 years before I retired, I would say, "What are you going to do?" I said, "Well, I'll windsurf. I really enjoy that. I'll go fishing a lot." Actually, by the time I retired, I could care less about windsurfing. I don't even know where my windsurf board is. Well, it turns out what I really like is what I like to do when I was 8 years old. Sit in a room and read and write before my father persuaded me that there was more to life than that.
So
well,
retirement.
That's what I do.
I mean, that's really profound. I'm going to make it sound
jargony. Is that on tape?
No. You're saying that retirement puts you in the presence of your freedom. I mean, it puts you in the presence of your freedom, and you, like, do with it what you will.
Yeah, come to think of it, that's what I meant.
Yeah. Well, let's take some more questions. Welcome to we've got a young person here. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, sir. What's your name and comment?
My name is Grant. I'm a graduate student in the philosophy department here, and I had a question about a common view about leisure time, which was that it's particularly conducive for philosophy, and this goes back to the ancient Greeks and seems like it's been a received view for basically the whole course of philosophy. But nowadays, it seems like leisure time has become onerous. There's this unending stream of information and entertainment that we need to keep up with. So I'm wondering if it's time to rethink whether retirement and leisure really is the most conducive way to do philosophy, or whether office hours and appointments keep us on track.
That's a very wise question. What's your field within philosophy?
Ancient philosophy.
Ancient philosophy, like really dead guys. Plato and Aristotle, I mean, they said you could do the program, I tried to find some stuff in Plato and Aristotle about retirement. There's not a lot there, because in those days, it was a class thing. I mean, if you were rich, you kind of were retired your whole life, and so forth and so on. Well, I think there's a paradox there that most graduate departments haven't really figured out, which is we really do think philosophy is something that you do best when you don't have too many concerns in the world, when you're relaxed, when you have time to think. So let's put together a graduate program in which person will have absolutely no leisure time. They'll either be TAing or taking a required course or something like that. Well, of course, it depends on leisure. But no, I think, that's one reason I finally decided to give up philosophy talk, because even though I had my life down to kind of maybe 3 days a week with big chunks of time taken for philosophy talk, which kind of rules it out for getting anything written, I still wanted more. I wanted more leisure time, but not for leisure, for writing and thinking. There's all these, what did Frege really mean in the big Rift-Schrift? And things like that. So I'm not giving a very good answer to your question, except to say it's an insightful question and you ought to write a dissertation about it. and start right away, don't waste any time.
So, I mean, one thing your question to me suggests is it's really hard to free yourself from all the habits and forces that have shaped you over most of your life. And so people who live and work in particular ways don't just become different people. I mean, you're an example of that. And sometimes that's to the good, but sometimes it's not, because people have been obeying other people their whole lives or, buying things their whole lives. And it's very hard to figure out how to throw that off.
So Josh, you really think I'm writing a last chapter to my personal novel, but I'm just fooling myself and thinking I'm not? That's just to read your mind.
Yeah, it's good mind reading. I can't decide. I need more time, with you lying on the couch and me therapizing you. Therapizing you. So it could be that you're just what, Galen Strawson calls an episodic, and you just don't care very much, and maybe mm-hmm. that's right. Or maybe you're just not as aware as you might be of the fact you're a description, beautiful description of what you think we should be doing in retirement. That sounds a lot like the John Perry I've always known.
Oh.
Is it really true that you're doing something radically different by sitting and thinking and writing, and even by putting everything into question? That's who you are. You're the guy who puts everything into question, except your intelligence, obviously, but, yeah. Right? So, I'm not totally convinced that, in fact, you're throwing narrative considerations completely out of the window.
Well, since I'm retired, I have time to catch up on my Josh Landy reading, my Nietzsche reading, but I don't think I'll do that. So maybe I'll change my mind.
Let's take another question. Welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thank you. I'm Linda, and I'm from San Francisco. And my question, I've been working at a certain institution of higher learning for about the last 24 years. but in a field that I studied that you could call art. And most people would, in their retirement, love to do something like photography all the time. But that's what I've been doing for a job. Mm-hmm. Now I look at retirement as a possible place where I could study harder, where I could get into more of a life of learning. And I wonder what you think about older learners in a rigorous program as an undergraduate.
Well, I think older learners in a rigorous program is a great idea. We have continuing education here, and then we actually have a master's program in the humanities within continuing education, which is a great program. And there's no reason learning should be relegated to the young. And actually, one of the things I thought I'd do when I retire is really learn mathematics, which I didn't do a very good job of the first time around. But like golf, it just seems to not be appealing to me when I get up in the morning to do that. But no, I think that's terrific, but you're a photographer. Yeah, that's what a lot of people would just think would be a wonderful retirement. But I guess, although nowadays, well, you have an iPhone, you don't have all those chemicals. What fun is that?
So this is one thing actually the United States does reasonably well, which is it invites people back to education. There's not like one ramp, and if you're off that ramp, you have no chance again of going back and being educated. People at all ages can make use of, whether it's the community college system or adult education, it's a really good thing. And it's a point about, you know, staying engaged and vital is being a lifelong learner. And we always tell our students we want them to be lifelong learners.
Now, Deborah, when I interviewed you to hire you, I said, what's your most fundamental belief? And I believe you said, from each according to their abilities. And to,
that was a younger Deborah.
To each according to their needs. I don't know where you got that. But
that was a younger Deborah.
So, but I was immediately struck by the plausibility of that. Does that suggest to you a way we ought to handle retirement?
Well, I do think that thinking about wages as tied, you know, just to productive work, as opposed to having a broader idea of productive contribution that people make over the course of their lives, taking care of children, taking care of their elderly relatives, would free us from this idea that there is a working life that's, you know, these years, and then you're, you know, as Josh put it, out to fallow.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, sir. What's your comment or question?
Thanks. So I think, you know, on this topic of lifelong learning, it's one thing to hang up your hat, and it's another thing to put down your pen. It's one thing to retire from Philosophy Talk, and it's another thing to retire from philosophy itself. And I guess my question is, insofar as, you know, you even now just said, oh, I hope to keep I'm going to keep writing, do you ever see, is there a time, either for you or even for philosophers past, when one puts down the pen, when one says, all right, pencil's down, like I've written my last word? Or is it a continuous rage against the dying of the light, a continuous pursuit of philosophy until it cannot be done?
I want to quote Charlton Heston. From my cold, dead hands, will he take this pen from me? Anyway, what's your?
Well, I would say the latter. And, you know, at my age, you can't help but think about senility and even Alzheimer's. And so I've been wondering, does Alzheimer's really affect your ability to do philosophy? I mean, because, my father had Alzheimer's. I mean, later on, you can't do anything. But in the early stages, you can't remember anybody's name. You can't remember whether you fed the dog. Actually, that's been most of my life. But you don't need to do those things to sit and read and write about Frege or Ken Taylor's most recent book. So I would say I'm looking forward to finding out the answer to that question. But I have no plans to drop the pen, and I actually have a real pen, a real fountain pen. Fountain pens and typewriters are another thing that, if I were an elder in charge of everything, would be much more common than they are.
So you'll be writing your last chapter with that pen.
Yeah. Yes, right, until I run out of ink. which is hard to find these days.
So, John, on that poignant note, I'm going to thank you for joining us. It's been a pleasure having you back as a guest. That's a little bit of a weird experience, having you as a guest, but it's been a real pleasure. Our guest has been the one and only John Perry. He's a professor emeritus of philosophy at Stanford University. He's the co-creator and co-founder of this lovely program, and now he's graduated to being our host emeritus of Philosophy Talk. Now, this conversation continues at Philosopher's Corner at our online community of thinkers, where our motto is, get this, cogito ergo blogo, I think, therefore I blog. You too can become a partner in the community by registering at our website, philosophytalk.org.
And if you have a question that wasn't addressed in today's show, either here or on the radio, we'd love to hear from you. Send your questions to us at comments@philosophytalk.org, and we might feature it on the aforementioned blog.
Now let's hear from someone who speeds through any crossroads. It's Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, the other day I was walking to the farmer's market. A homeless woman who sells the street sheet every day was heading my way, yelling obscenities at some other homeless guy. As I passed, she asked if I wanted to make a donation. She said she was clocking out. It was 3 p.m. I thought, keeping banker's hours now, are we? A little early to leave the office, isn't it? Then I realized she doesn't have an office, just a corner, and probably does not even have a clock. She was 70-something and did not seem employable, and yet she still thought of herself as a working gal on the job. Americans have very mixed feelings about retirement. You get congratulations and a life well lived. Enjoy your golden years with this hearty farewell golden watch from us, your co-workers. You used to get a pension, but that money got siphoned off when the company got sold to pay for the former CEO's golden parachute. Is the former CEO retired? No, he's consulting. He's on the board. He's power lunching. He's golfing, which is now considered work. And he is envied. The retired are hated. Why do you get to watch Judge Judy all day while I'm still crunching numbers miles away from a corner office, much less a window? And there's also the onus of anybody not working. You sick, you don't lurch when you walk, you look okay to me, get back to your cube. And when we do have leisure activities, it's always golf. You gotta spend money on clubs and lessons and memberships and drinks and lunches, and you can't just play the game, you have to obsess over it. And you watch other games, like football. Again, you can't just watch it, you have to use taxpayer money to build a stadium. And when football players who are working hard for their money dare to have an opinion by kneeling for the national anthem, we threaten to boycott football, which means empty stadiums. Your team moves to Vegas, and your town goes bankrupt even faster. And athletes retire young. When they invest all their money in restaurants or car dealerships and lose it, it makes us feel a little better, mixed in with bitterness and gloating, both enjoyed enormously by retirees. Some people never retire at all. Gunslingers, generals, judges, horses don't retire. They're put out to stud. We don't do that with humans. We could, now that we have Viagra, but getting women to enter that pasture would be problematic. It's moot, anyway. Soon we'll all be retired. When robots take over driving and running corporations, we'll all paint and write novels. Novelists never retire. John le Carré is in his 80s and still writing. And, of course, college professors never really retire. You get a Pulitzer or a Nobel or tenure and become emeritized, emulated, and asked to contribute a blurb to a book or write a review of some upstart's book trying to undo what you did 20 years ago. Is retirement an insult or an honor? It's relative, because here's another thing about retirement. Many Americans, conservatives to be frank, view pensions as a big wasted pie. It's just sitting there, being nibbled away by people not doing anything for it. Mark my words, the pension haters will eventually get their way. They can't stand to see it just sitting there like a lake. You gotta jump into it, make it move, fill it up with water skis and piranha. But they're not gonna take your pension away. No, they're going to put it on the market, invest it for you, which means set fire to it with unique new financial tools that only robots understand. And when it's all gone, well, it will be your fault. You shouldn't have retired. Maybe you can pawn the gold watch for some broccoli. Oh, and the street sheet vendors at the farmer's market take Bitcoin. That's a pro tip. I gotta go.
Golden hands at midnight, 'neath the starry sky. Nice work if you can get it. And you can get it if you try.
Philosophy Talk is a production of KALW Local Public Radio, San Francisco, and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University Copyright 2017.
Our executive producers are David Demarest and Matt Martin. Special thanks to the Stanford Philosophy Department, the School of Humanities and Sciences, and the Office of Public Affairs.
Thanks also to Dan Brandon, Conchita Perales, and our musical guests, Amber Gugis and Marco Casasola.
The senior producer of Philosophy Talk is Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research. Our marketing director is Sydney Prince-Baum.
Support from Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University and from the partners at our online community of thinkers.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program don't represent necessarily the opinions of Stanford University or our funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable. The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you too can become a partner in our community of thinkers. I'm Josh Landy.
I'm Deborah Satz.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.